Okay, so to recap, we've seen two deep and mysterious facts about topological strings. First, we saw that topological string partition function, though computable and by now used in so many applications, is actually a wave function, a statement which is embarrassingly poorly understood despite all these computations. One other point that we saw in the first part is that it's actually a Hartley-Hawking wave function in a certain flux compactification of string theory, a point which is also pretty mysterious and deserves much better study and scrutiny, but which might eventually actually shed light on the origin of this bizarre fact that it's a wave function. Yes?
I don't know if this is the appropriate context. I have a very naive question about flux compactification.
Sure.
Fluxes in general deform the background.
Yeah.
And they don't do it in a continuous way, right? Because fluxes are discrete.
That's right.
Do we know that if you take into account that this deformation that the moduli spaces can still be discussed in terms of the moduli spaces of Calabi-Yau's? Or do people take into account are the moduli spaces changed? Do people take that into account? Has that been discussed, thought about?
Well, certainly fluxes back react. And that back reaction is usually controllable, and in 90% of flux compactification papers, this question is ignored, stating either explicitly in the first few paragraphs of the introduction that we are not going to consider that, or tacitly assuming that's the case. Now, back reaction is part where zero modes of a Calabi-Yau start interacting with other modes of the geometry, other moduli or mat shape variations. And this is a very good question. So I don't think it has been analyzed how that works. There are usual so all the facts we're going to use, and in fact the reason 90% or 100% of these flux compactification papers are correct is that often you have some no-go theorems which prevent certain interactions, or if you look at holomorphic quantities, the point is that it's okay to kind of continue to think about same deformations in the deformed, I mean, same moduli in the deformed theory. So this is the basic reason why answers make sense. But then on top of that, one could ask further questions of what should we do to incorporate this interaction.
I have to admit a little skepticism to that, because I think I know examples where you can show that the moduli space is changed drastically. For example, when you turn on an NS...
Moduli space is not quite the right notion here, because see, okay. I mean, fluxes lift all the moduli anyway, so... In fact, right question, so it gets modified, obviously. Question to ask is, for instance, when we write this flux superpotential, shall we write it as a superpotential of just the same set of moduli as we had on the original Calabi-Yau, mm-hmm. or some larger set of moduli?
Or smaller.
Larger is actually more natural, and I can argue that, yes, in fact, it should be viewed as a superpotential which depends on more parameters than just moduli in the original Calabi-Yau compactification, but I'm saying that we can think of those guys as integrated out, and it doesn't change the answer. So this is the reason which makes all of these kind of things work. And I mean, there are various realizations of what I just said in different contexts. So one can argue that in all of these instances, ignoring or integrating out this extra field doesn't modify the answer. So.
What makes me uneasy about it is the fact, as I said, fluxes are quantized, so you don't have a continuous parameter.
Right.
So maybe to make it a bit more intuitive is, suppose you have n equal to supersymmetry as you have in the classification, and you want to break it.
No, forget about
No, it's fluid flux with the genesis. Right, yes.
Well, for example, if you turn on an S3 quorum flux, S3 cross S1,
well,
WCW model doesn't break it.
But you could have arranged special cases which doesn't, but generically it breaks it. And the way you understand it from n equal to 2 is the question. Mm-hmm. So suppose you start n equal to supersymmetric theory. Mm-hmm. There's an integral over superspace which is bigger than what would be allowed in the flux compactification. You could ask, okay, turning on flux, what does it do from the perspective when it turns out to correspond to turning on certain auxiliary fields which break there from the supersymmetry.
Sure.
So that means that the data of the pre-potential of the Calabi-Yau, which goes into writing the n equal to 2, can also be used to write the superpotential in the n equals to 1 broken theory by a flux. So therefore, the question that you're asking, how could the flux data not affect the theory? Of course, it affects it. For example, you didn't have superpotential before. But the data of the prepotential can be used to generate a notion of the superpotential. And in fact, that's how the data gets used in the context of it.
I think you're not taking, when you do that, you're not taking into account the back reaction on the geometry itself, on the kinetic terms.
It doesn't affect it. So it certainly affects the D terms. The D terms get modified. But not the F term. The F term data of n equals to 1 can be read off from the A equals to data, and that's OPV use to try to find the critical point. You don't need to know the D terms. Of course, the Kähler potential of n equals to 1 is no longer under control when you do this.
But suppose you had turned on fluxes in such a way that it doesn't break n equal to 2. So, for example, we know S, for example, you can have a compactification on WCW model SU2 cross SU2, right, with some, you need some dilaton. Soak up the central charge, but you can do that. That still has n equal to supersymmetry.
Yeah, you could arrange certain cases which it has, but I'm using even less data. I'm using the superpotential data.
Okay.
And I'm not even, one doesn't even claim to know everything about the broken flux, unlike the D terms. In the case of n equal to 2, the kinetic terms are also fixed by prepotential. You don't trust it anymore in n equals to 1.
Okay.
But superpotential part you trust, and that's all people use to classify the value.
I see. Okay.
So, since I have to record this, and just to reiterate the question is why n equals 2 data can be used to do n equals 1 formalism, in n equals 1 formalism. This is non-trivial question, but again, the answer is that because typically of holomorphy and similar arguments, some special quantities can be computed in n equals 1 using n equals 2 results. It's a non-trivial statement, but I'm saying that for certain quantities it goes through, meaning that back reaction doesn't change them. It obviously changes lots of other things, and this is a very good problem to, in again, all this 90% papers on flux impactifications, take it into account and see what the effects are. They may be actually good phenomenologically, or bad, I don't know. So, but some quantities, and all quantities that we discussed today are going to be insensitive to this back reaction.
I don't understand why is it that fluxes only does the auxiliary.
Well, why, it's hard to explain, but it does.
Well, but it's a straightforward computation once you know that Ramon field is realized on a in the Wall Street description using spinners. You just write it down, see what kind of multiply they sit in, and they happen to sit on the vector multiplet and be auxiliary field. So, it's not something I can do right on the board, but it's a straightforward thing to check.
And there was another comment that Martin made, was the discreteness of the flux. And indeed, in the breaking from n equal to 2 n equal to 1, it doesn't show up. A priori, you could have had a continuous flux. And that could have been okay. It's just the consistency of the full theory demands it, but no fact from supersymmetry or anything like that allows it, needs it to be.
Yeah. Right. In fact, since all these flux superpotentials are all about effective low energy theory, both in 10 dimensions and in 4 dimensions, we just need supergravity, which doesn't see discreteness of the fluxes. So, of course, on top of that, one could expect that string theory might change things dramatically, but good thing it doesn't. So, okay, so coming back to the Hartley-Hawking wave function, that given these two statements in the morning, we now have for very special type of a spatial manifold M9, we can actually start addressing some questions. So how is wave function usually used? In quantum mechanics, we use it to compute correlation function or average of a certain operator. So we take psi, insert some interesting operators here, and take another psi. So this is an integral over variables, wherever they are, psi squared. Then again, this operators that we want to measure, and we usually divide it by just partition function, which doesn't, or alright, and here for some normalization factor. Okay, so here our wave function depends on the moduli of Calabi-Yau. So the kind of averages that we can study with this wave function are average shapes or average moments of the shape of the Calabi-Yau, right? And this may translate to different physical questions depending on the setup. So the basic idea is that about average or preferred shape of the Calabi-Yau threefold X. Okay. This is what we can do in general with this wave function. And now I'll give you two practical applications of this statement. I'll use this fact, this wave function, in two different contexts. One to produce some toy model of string cosmology. Following more closely the original idea of Hartley and Hawking when they proposed this wave function. And another model will be roughly a toy model of string phenomenology. Where shapes of the Calabi-Yau will be used to determine the effective physics in four dimensions, and this is where the phenomenology model is going to lead. Okay, so now let me come back to the first one and describe the setup and the results, and then we'll do the same for the second one. Okay, since our space-time M9, I'll write it again here, is S1 cross S2 cross X, I should have started a bit more slowly and tell you the motivation for it and more the usual setup of Hartley and Hawking. So the kind of question we want to ask is about density perturbations in the early universe, which we can now measure with various experiments, notably WMAP, which is releasing its wonderful data. And these are experiments which probe how metric in the early universe was distorted, so to say. And one of the amazing facts, so it's about correlation functions of the metric G mean nu, del G mean nu, or rho lambda. This would be the two-point function of the metric fluctuation. And one could ask about higher-order correlation functions. Since this is a tensor, it has various different tensor structure, etc. So interestingly, these correlation functions can now be measured, and they turn out to be extremely small and have very interesting properties. So if you look at the trace piece of the metric fluctuation, which is usually denoted by phi, we can call it phi of x and phi of y, where these are coordinates. Now I'm talking about the real universe we live in.
So phi is the trace of delta g.
Yes. Or we could actually equivalently write this phi of k and phi of minus k, where these are corresponding momentum vector in the Fourier transform. So this is what's called a scalar correlation function. Then this goes, first of all, it's very small. It's incredibly small. And secondly, it has the characteristic property that it goes like k to the minus 3, absolute value of k to the minus 3. So there, this is what's observed. I'm just telling you the result of the experiment. Now, standard theory, which is supposed to explain this, is a theory of inflation, which is a period in time, which we've heard about very briefly last week, and probably we'll hear more in the course of the workshop, which stretches the space in a way which makes all such perturbations very small, and in the end achieves very naturally this spectrum, which is called scale invariant spectrum. Now, this is one particular model of cosmology, and another model you could imagine is where such density perturbations would naturally come out if you take this average with respect to Hartley-Hawking wave function. So it's natural to think that this would be really nothing but psi g mu nu g lambda rho psi in the very same way I just wrote it previously. Okay, for after all, the wave function depends on the metric, so it's a very natural thing to compute. And people have tried to do this kind of computation with a ordinary Hartley-Hawking wave function. They didn't produce realistic results. They didn't recover this result. So it's natural to try to repeat same type of computation now in string theory, since we have Hartley-Hawking wave function for that particular flux complexification.
Sorry, did you say it did or did not reproduce?
It did not. I'm referring to Turok and others. Maybe there are some, I mean, certainly there are several models and ways to use it in the usual gravity, which run into many difficulties, particularly related to the choice of the mean superspace, etc. But at least at the papers of Turok, Hawking and Turok and others that I've looked at, it didn't really work, or at least they had quite a handful of problems to make it work.
It's just one question. Question of interpretation: is the Hartley-Hawking wave function supposed to give you, the conditions at the beginning of inflation or at the end of it?
No, it's good question. It's alternative to inflation. So inflation,
alternative.
It's alternative. Inflation achieves this, but yes.
You can interpret it in both ways. So that's why I'm a little bit confused about your question. I mean, in many scenarios, actually, it's considered as the concept. The only thing the Hartley-Hawking wave function gives you is initial condition inflation.
Right, but then.
And in fact, because the second phase is playing inflation, you do get this result.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
The only way the Hartley-Hawking wave function affects it is by the initial condition. And it actually predicts right.
Sure, but only because inflation does.
Scenario, which
yeah.
Is the one that you're describing.
Yeah, so good. I mean, it's important to distinguish these two possibilities. In the first one, if you use a Hartley-Hawking wave function as initial stage for inflation, then it doesn't play really much role. It just sets the stage for inflation itself, and you get this right answer because of inflation, not because of the Hartley-Hawking wave function. So, another I think it gets completely washed away. We can discuss it later, but point is...
Well, it would play the role of telling you whether you can get inflation.
No, actually, that's even different, because to get inflation, you would have to have the right choice of inflaton potential, etc. So that's yet another question. So, I mean, there are several questions which go into building the right model of cosmology here. So all I'm trying to focus on just two ingredients, inflation, which is the standard ingredient, and Hartley-Hawking wave function for initial conditions, which could be used either before inflation or as an alternative to it. If you use it before inflation, then we really don't get that much use of the Hartley-Hawking by itself. If you use it instead of inflation, then it becomes really interesting. It's really an alternative, but now we can just run the whole machinery and see if the correlation function we get is the right answer or not. So this is the setup I'm going to explore. This more cavalier and ambitious use of Hartley-Hawking, which is much simpler, but on the other hand, this leads to very specific predictions that one would like to check. Make sense?
You should still get very, very close to the right.
Sorry?
You should still get very, very close to the right answer. It's all determined by the symmetries. Hartley-Hawking is just the continuation of the sphere. So most part of the correlation is determined by the symmetry.
No, not really. Well, I mean, the answer I'll give you here will be, you could even naively run the argument about symmetries in the context I'm going to present, and as I say, it won't work. And it doesn't work also for Hawking and Turok and in their approach. So,
I suppose, in principle, shouldn't there be some sort of something like a renormalization group argument that says, you should be able to interpret the Hartley-Hawking wave function at various. It shouldn't matter where you put it, in some sense.
Well, going from Euclidean to Minkowski solution is just only connected as a turning point. It depends on what you want to do. Abstracting the Euclidean space, you're absolutely right. But if you want to connect it to a Minkowski solution,
of course. So that should tell you what it is. You don't have a choice.
Yeah, actually, I should speed up a little bit because I'm being a little bit slow here. So, okay, now let me try to use this setup again as alternative to inflation and see what kind of answer we get. This is going to be toy model, so don't take it too seriously and don't ask about all other questions. I just want to run it quickly and set the stage, and then we can go to details later, or if one is willing to, there are ways to repeat these computations in more elaborate and maybe more realistic models. So just to explain what it could be used for, I should do the following. Again, we assume that our universe is maximally invariant, meaning that we live on a spatial slice, which is something like S3. So the only way I can find a 3-sphere in this spatial geometry is by putting it inside the Calabi-Yau. Okay? So this is the way, which is a little bit perverse. It goes contrary to the usual intuition where we compactify and take Calabi-Yau to be finite. And this time, we actually make part of the Calabi-Yau large and, in fact, represent our world where we live to be this 3-sphere. Okay? So, and you can think of these other guys, all other factors in this geometry as being tiny and a very small size. Now, the variation of the moduli of Calabi-Yau leads to variation of the metric on this 3-sphere, right? So since we have a wave function which depends on the moduli, since we have this psi top which depends on the moduli of Calabi-Yau T, we can actually go ahead and compute the variation of the metric, but not arbitrary variation, because moduli, if I think of this as complex structure moduli, determine only complex structure of the Calabi-Yau, not the actual metric. So the right question to ask would be, what is the variation of the metric on the 3-sphere induced from such moduli, which actually corresponds to the complex structure of the Calabi-Yau? And to address this, it's very natural to define this scalar part of the metric perturbation to be the overall scale, so to say, of omega by writing it like this. Okay, so we start with some given complex structure and then vary it by this dilaton looking like-looking factor, e to the phi, and we could ask, what is the correlation function of this complex field phi with itself? Say, two-point function, for instance. So now, to make this setup more explicit, we specialize to look at the fluctuation of S3 in a conifold geometry, which is, so S3 seeking an equilibrium has local neighborhood of, if this is a special Lagrangian cycle, then local neighborhood of it is Q star of S3, which is deformed conifold and can be described by equations x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared plus x4 squared equals mu, okay? So, roughly speaking, this defines an equation, this topology T star of S3 in C4. It's a hypersurface in C4, where absolute value of this parameter mu is, roughly speaking, the radius of the three-sphere. So this will keep constant, but we can also construe deformations of this hypersurface by adding various terms on the right-hand side, which depend on these coordinates, and roughly could be thought of as in the form epsilon of xi, or epsilon as sum of various polynomials, which correspond to different spherical harmonics on the three-sphere. They'll change induced complex structure according to expansion in the spherical harmonics on S3. I won't make this correspondence more precise, but it's important that this model, which is very nice and cosmology-inspired model of local fluctuations of Calabi-Yau, is actually completely solvable by the following fact, that the topological string wave function, which is Z top, in this case is actually equal to C equals 1 matrix model partition function at the cell of dual radius. And in particular, if here I look at the deformations, which depend only on, roughly speaking, two of the variables, x1 and x2, for instance, then we have a very explicit answer for this partition function. I'll write it more explicitly by writing hypersurface equation in the form xy minus cw equals mu plus sum over n positive Tn x to the n minus t minus n y to the n. Okay. So this is a particular form of the deformation, and we know very explicit form of the topological string partition function due to its relation to the C equals 1 state, where these deformations correspond to the tachyon momentum modes, which couple to these parameters Tn. In the C equals 1 string, these are kind of coefficients in the generating function of the tachyon scattering amplitude. And for us, these are precisely the complex structure moduli of this geometry. Okay, so using this relation, one can compute correlation function of, say, t and t minus n, okay? Then work out a relation between the variable phi here, sorry, the field phi, which is the scale factor, and the deformation of the geometry epsilon. So there is a way which tells you how to express epsilon, which is function of x and t n, in terms of, actually, I can write it down to make it more. Yeah, it's not very mysterious. It's just some kinematics which you can easily unwrap by writing x p to the half e to the I theta, y equals p to the half e to the minus I theta, introducing some variables like this. And then it's actually very easy to see that in the leading approximation, the scalar field phi phi of x and t is roughly dp of epsilon, which also depends on x and tn. Okay. Now, you can take a correlation function of these two guys, or in fact as many as you want. And average it over the data . So correlation function would look as follows: phi of x1 phi of xk is integral over this moduli. Now phi of x1 phi of xk psi of t n squared normalized properly. Okay, I'm just writing the definition of that correlation function. So using this relation and explicit tensor for correlations of t's, you can evaluate, for instance, two-point function of two fields, phi n, phi minus n, and the answer comes out to be the following. It looks like g string squared over 8 mu squared, which is string coupling and the radius of the sphere, and then m cubed. This is just a result of straightforward computation using this relation to the C equals 1 matrix model. And if you translate this to usual Fourier space in four dimensions, you get on R3, you get phi k phi minus k is equal, or again goes to as g string squared times k without power minus 3. So this is the crucial distinction between this result, how three sphere fluctuates inside a Calabi-Yau, versus what's measured. So even though it has spherical symmetry and similar properties to, similar symmetries to what you might expect, the result is somewhat different. It still depends just on absolute value of k, but with a different power. Okay.
It's big instead of small.
Yeah, that's right. Quite different.
Is the fact that it's a non-compact Calabi-Yau here?
Well, I don't think so. Although it might be interesting to look at fluctuations of geometry of three spheres and other three-dimensional cycles and compact Calabi-Yaus in cases where we know this topological string partition function fairly explicitly as a function of handful of moduli, many enough that we can extract dependence on the momentum, because basically each complex structure parameter here, Tn, corresponds to a momentum mode. So in order to see this law, it wouldn't be sufficient to look at Calabi-Yau which has only two moduli. We need many enough. And what helped us in this case is that because it was non-compact, there is infinite set of deformations which correspond to spectral function here in the momentum space.
This is the analog of the universal space. So if you have a monoconstruct bundle and a manifold, you have a universal space and you map it and you still have the bundle. So a conifold is the non-compact one of the universal space for any SPF chain in Calabi-Yau. Any answer you get for the compact case can be embedded into this answer by pulling back. So this is the full answer, no matter how you realize this inside the Calabi-Yau. The only thing which is going to be complicated is that the deformation is going to be complicated for a compact Calabi-Yau. Might be difficult to find exactly the point where you are at the given compact Fabio, but certainly it's not an extra problem, it's a simple subsurface problem.
But what is with the winding modes? I mean, why can we...
No, he's just doing the subset.
Yeah.
Can we do that?
If we knew the winding modes, we don't know the... I mean, morally, yes, but the question is, technically, we don't know how to compute them.
But then you could reconstruct some other compact Calabi, right?
To get full Calabi, you need to know the all the formation of sequels to one. We only know the momentum modes.
Yes, the problem is that in the sequel one, these correlators are not calculated, or what?
Well, we don't have a full calculation for correlation. Some
of them, but not all.
Some of them have been computed, but not...
Yeah.
I'm confused about the dimensions. I mean, how can you compare this correlation function of a scalar field if you use that dimension one half of the computation of the standard topology for a scalar?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So string coupling constant should be thought of either as dimensional. I mean, it carries a dimension. Or put differently, if you make it dimensionless, there is this parameter mu which appears here. So it will make the dimension right. So. No.
It's
very high K. That's a very good question, because I don't have, I mean, I really now have to speed up way more. But point is that since we have explicit answer, you can actually see in which regime we can actually trust it. And point is that we can trust this answer as long as n g string squared over mu squared, which has a dimensionless quantity here, is much less than 1. So otherwise, you start getting corrections from loops and kind of loops in this effective action for this t mode. So which, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Here.
Yeah, so in this setup, we are doing B models. So point is that topological wave function is a B model partition function, which independently is known to be the same as C equals 1 matrix model, and using those results from...
Yeah, I was thinking J holomorphic curves don't look very good in that T star S3.
Not at all.
They have to go off to infinity if it exists at all.
Yeah. But B model does look good.
Yeah, B model looks good.
It's this very beautiful hypersurface. Okay, so very quickly, the second application that we're currently exploring is slightly different. So here we had a three-sphere, our universe, embedded as a part of the Calabi-Yau. So roughly, this could be called as some kind of Calabi-Yau cosmology. But more conventional way to obtain four-dimensional physics is where you start in 10 dimensions, d equals 10, compactify a Calabi-Yau and get to d equals 4. And ignoring the fact that our space-time had S2 and S1 as a factor, we can just take this wave function, which depends on moduli, again, take z top as a function of t, absolute value squared, and think of it as a measure or probability density for on the space of string vector or flux vector, to be more precise. Okay. So, again, the general philosophy is that this wave function could tell us information about how the shape of the Calabi-Yau fluctuates, which...
So does this mean the space of metrics is satisfied by this complicated equation that starts off with the Calabi-Yau equation that gives conformal invariance to this string theory? This is a sigma model? I mean, what is it? I don't know what string vacuum means. Well, what do you mean by it?
I should probably clarify this a little bit. So, lately there has been a lot of interest in studying string compactifications with fluxes. which end up in four-dimensional maximally symmetric space. Typically, it's ADS vacuum, but we'll ignore this for a second. Okay, so if these are some discrete points on the moduli space of Calabi-Yau, discrete because of superpotential or potential induced on by the fluxes, etc. And if you want to produce some kind of statistical or probabilistic answer from this, you would have to have a measure on the space of such vacuum. I mean, you'll hear much more about it. I mean, it's called the landscape. So you think of different just potential, which has a bunch of critical points. These are discrete vacua, and they have many different properties because they correspond to different shapes of Calabi-Yau, and in Kolodziejczyk-Klein reduction, shapes determine the four-dimensional physics properties of particles, electrons, etc. So before we draw any conclusion about which masses of electrons are more likely than the other, you would have to have a measure on such or probability density for such vacuum to be realized. This is the main issue in this probabilistic approach. So we don't have a good measure, so this, without more serious motivation, we could take this just as a possible measure and see what kind of answers one gets. I mean, whether it's right or not is a different question, but it is a measure prescribed from this Hartley-Hawking wave function. So this is a picture of moduli. So again, I'm going to do the same kind of calculation. We're going to compute, roughly speaking, psi, then correlators of various moduli with respect to this wave function to see which moduli I preferred and which are less preferred. But now interpretation is going to be different. We'll think of it really as a compactification on a Calabi-Yau, and moduli will tell us what kind of physics we have. Okay? So, first, so now let me modify this picture a little bit. I'll think of it as plot of psi squared, psi of t squared with respect to moduli, and once you have a Calabi-Yau, once you have psi top or z top, you know what the answer is, you know how this function looks like. So you could naturally ask, what about its critical points here, what's so special about them, which correspond to maxima and minima? So in the remaining 3 minutes, let me tell you what you get. So, roughly speaking, these critical points of this probability density of this measure, if you take it seriously, are something like attractor points. And this is not very surprising because the original derivation for the stringy wave function used connection with black holes. And in fact, it was already argued, explained by Aguri, Waffe, and Verlinde that this stringy wave function is peaked at the attractor points of Calabi-Yau, which are points in the moduli space which satisfy a very interesting relation. In our case, the equation would be of the following form. Here, summation over index j is assumed, and I and j run from 1 to number of moduli. So in this context, we're exploring a variational problem which has one of the moduli of Calabi-Yau fixed. This is what we call x0 in the very, very beginning, which could be chosen to be integral of a holomorphic form of the over a zero cycle. So this is kept fixed, and it has a meaning that we're exploring variation by keeping string coupling fixed. It makes sense also because the whole prepotential, which was exponential of the partition function, was homogeneous in this variable. So if we did vary with respect to it, we would get very trivial answer just by setting it to zero. So we would run into very obvious conclusion. So to avoid this and to make, which has good physical meaning, we set this variational this period to be fixed and vary with respect to other moduli, which I call A here. So A dual is derivative of the prepotential f of A with respect to A, and tau aj here, as usual, is second derivative with respect to ai and aj. Okay. Now, something interesting happens. First of all, this equation is already, as you can see, given prepotential or topological string partition function, is a highly nonlinear equation, but it's not a differential equation. It's a system of ordinary equations on the moduli of Calabi-Yau. Secondly, you can convince yourself that these equations have solutions which are generically isolated points on the moduli space. Okay, so this is the moduli space of a Calabi-Yau, and generically solutions would be isolated points. Okay. Now, if you want this point to be either maximum or minimum, and not some other kind of critical point, which is like a saddle point or inflection point or something like that, then you have to actually look at a specific solution sphere, which are of the form im A equals im A dual equals zero. As you can easily convince yourself, these are indeed solutions to these equations. And if you look at these equations, which look a bit easier, you basically require that all A and B periods, except for the one which we keep fixed, are real or have the same phase, then such points are also, such solutions are also given by isolated points in the moduli space. So again, the space of solutions is discrete. Now, I want to make a few comments about this specific form of equation, and this is the last statement I want to make here. So the solutions have many remarkable properties apart from resemblance to attractor points or complex multiplication that I already mentioned. So they have the following meaning. So first of all, they tell us that all but one period have the same phase. So if you look at the A periods and B periods on a Calabi-Yau, it means that except for one, which we kept fixed, all of the other periods will be aligned as complex numbers. They'll have the same phase. What it means in physics is that D-brain bound states, DPS bound states, become marginal and you can see immediately from the BPS formula given in the handout, because it's given by absolute value of sums of these guys, and if these numbers happen to be real, then it immediately follows that you can drop the absolute value sign, and this is precisely the signature for marginal bound states of D-brains. In fact, it's a maximal set of D-brain states becoming marginal that you could possibly wish for. Okay. Another interesting property is that it has maximum, or I should put differently, say that preferred, it prefers effective theories which have negative beta function, which is precisely the class of asymptotically free theories. This is also not so hard to see. I don't have much time to explain it, but a point is that basically if you look at the variation of the functional psi tau squared and look at the second variation around the critical point given by these equations, what happens is that sine of the beta function gets correlated with either it is maximum or minimum, and precisely for asymptotically free theories, it happens to be maximum. So it's a nice conclusion. I don't know what to make more of it. As an example of such phenomena, you could look at a singular point in the moduli space of O0 plus O minus 2 bundle over P1, where vector multiplied becomes massless, so you get extra gauge degree of freedom, and you would expect that effective theory precisely has negative beta function around such point, contrary to the Kanifold, which has hypermultiplied becoming massless. And it does indeed, you can very easily check by looking at the explicit form of the topological string partition function that this guy indeed has a sharp maximum around such point. Okay, I apologize for running over time and wish to stop here. So here, okay, I should say that, first of all, there are a few technical points which I'm not sure would be useful here, but what was going on is, first of all, we looked at one specific, there is a wave function for any set of charges or choice of homology classes, which would correspond to the choice of flux. Here, this last part, which I described, refers to compactification actually without flux. So it's interesting that there is some kind of canonical wave function here, which you would naturally associate to Calabi-Yau, which doesn't need any choice of flux. So it's already within context of n equals 2, and yet you get some interesting measure, some interesting answer on the moduli space. Now, in more general class, which do involve fluxes, its original setup where this wave function was obtained is slightly different and involves space-time, which has S2 cross S1 geometry as well as Calabi-Yau part. So it's slightly different context, right? But assuming that it carries over, so even before I talk about questions of supersymmetry, breaking, etc., supersymmetry is preserved here, but it doesn't really have space-time over four-dimensional phenomenological model that you would expect, right? So we just here assume that it carries over to compactification on Calabi-Yau with flux. And this is not unreasonable because this problem does share a lot of features with the usual flux compactification, so I would expect that to be a very reasonable assumption. So, but to answer your question, everything is supersymmetric and stable because of supersymmetry in this setup, almost by default, because the problem is considered on the moduli space of Calabi-Yau and all the vacua are supersymmetric.
You still have to worry about moduli stabilization, no?
Right, but as I'm saying, it's a complementary question, right? So first of all, right, we're just exploring here the properties of the measure on the moduli space obtained from a slightly different class of questions and from slightly different problem. So how to patch it together with the usual flux compactification is not addressed here. So that's what I'm trying to say. And I think that many properties of what we are finding will carry over to that setup, but we didn't study it. And it's a natural expectation, but I don't have a proof of this.
Okay, since we have discussed the be around. Fine, we can continue discussion around 2:30 where there are references here. Thanks.
Oh, yeah.